Single Motherhood, the radio show for single women who proactively build families on their own. I'm your host, Mickey Morissette, writer and editor of books, articles, blogs, and multimedia for the Choice Mom community. In today's show, we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of single parenthood.
It's simple things. These things don't have to, in fact, often it's better if they don't cost any money. It can be as simple as baking chocolate chip cookies. There's a wonderful quote from William Blake, the English poet, who described childhood as seeing a world in a grain of sand and holding infinity in the palm of your hand.
It did come up with a lot of moms. Am I doing the right thing by not having a man in my bedroom or a man down the hall? Is this somehow going to make him less boyish?
The culture in general ends up vilifying the single family. As, you know, a child who grows up in that environment is automatically doomed to be a social failure, an economic failure, a psychological, when that is just patently untrue.
Role models are all over, and boys can engage with men.
Kids who are suffering from childhood depression and anxiety, suicide and substance abuse are now most prevalent in the smart downtown apartments and leafy suburbs where the go-getting middle classes are piling the pressure on their kids, project managing them.
Choosing Single Motherhood is where you'll find answers, hear stories, and connect with other single women who are making choices just like you. Welcome to the discussion. Welcome to the journey. I recently returned from a workshop I did in Los Angeles. I attended it with my daughter for the first time, and it was a really great opportunity for me to not only show off what I feel I myself have accomplished in 10 years as a choice mom. One woman actually pointed out that were it not for Sophia, I would not have written my book, Choosing Single Motherhood. I would not be doing this radio show, and I would not be hosting these choice mom events around the country. I also had a chance to meet some old friends from New York City who have relocated to the Los Angeles area. These were friends that I knew in my pre-mom single days, so I got a sense of where I've come in these 10 short years. One of the things that I know tends to trip us up, and certainly some of the women I had a chance to meet with at the Los Angeles workshop were in that same space as thinkers, really worrying about what the future might hold, not only what the future might hold if they don't have children, but what the future might hold if they do have children. We do tend to be very goal-oriented women, as I often say, and that also means we tend to be pretty conscientious, pretty responsible. We tend to plan. As a result, that makes us strong thinkers who will think of everything that could possibly go wrong on the path to motherhood. One of the women I met in Los Angeles talked to me about her concerns that as a fellow writer, she was worried that she might not be able to do what she does for a living while working from home with a young child and fluctuating income, whether this realistically was not something she could do financially. There are also no end of questions we have about will we even be able to conceive. The fertility doctor we had at the workshop, Dr. Charles March of California Fertility Partners, was inundated with questions for most of the afternoon. We also had an estate attorney, Charles Schultz, with another one of the very common concerns that women have at these workshops. Will I be able to protect my child legally and financially? Again, all signs that we are extremely, as a community, very conscientious, responsible women. With that can come almost a tendency to overplan. I'm sure many of us relate to this idea that we're almost too detail-oriented. We think almost too much of the logistics of everything that could go wrong in every situation. A great sign of our sense of responsibility, but that's also what can sink a lot of women when they're trying to figure out if this is the right step for them. I certainly know many of the women who were thinkers at the event who had a chance to meet with a lot of the choice moms that came. We had a very good turnout of moms, as well as the women who have taken that leap of faith into trying. We had several pregnant women at the event and those who are in the process of adoption. I tend to get a lot of thanks at these events from women who realize that they can march confidently forward with this, that their concerns are certainly quite common, and certainly we must listen to them. I always maintain this is not the choice for everyone. One of the things that we can also recognize is that our overplanning and overthinking sometimes makes it hard to just take that leap. One of the people we're going to be talking to on today's show is Carl Honoré, who's written the book Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. One of the reasons I really wanted to talk to him was, again, as very conscientious, responsible, work-oriented women, we might also have the tendency to almost project manage our children. And this is something he's seen not just with the Choice Mom community, which he's not been particularly studying, but he's met with a lot of married families and has written this really excellent book about how we not only have overscheduled our own lives, but we then transfer that onto our kids. Because of all the Choice Moms I've met over the years, I do know, and this is certainly the case for myself as well, that we can overpressure our kids. Because of the very work-oriented nature that we have ourselves had for 10, 20 years before we even become parents. So Carl Honoré is one of the guests that we'll be talking to today, a little bit about what I consider to be the ugly part of single parenting, something we need to be watchful for. Carl has some really good insight in today's show about that. The other author I talked to for today's show is Peggy Drexler, who wrote the book Raising Boys Without Men, How Maverick Moms Are Creating the Next Generation of Exceptional Men. And in this case, obviously, she very much has studied the Choice Mom community, as well as the lesbian couple community. Her book came out a few years ago, and those of you who are familiar with it might recall that it caused a lot of controversy, because she was saying, not only do single parent and lesbian couples do a great job of raising boys, but in some ways, they even do a better job. It's kind of a controversial piece of it, and certainly that wasn't her primary contention. I talked to her about many subjects, including how to deal with aggression in boys, which I'll use in a future show. But for today's show, we talk about what I consider the bad of single parenting and the good of single parenting. She has been married many years and has raised two kids with her husband. She's able to give really great insight about the strengths of two-parent homes, but then as well the strengths of single-parent homes. Before we get into our guests for today, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about one of the things I learned about myself over the weekend. As I mentioned, I was in Los Angeles. I brought my daughter and saw some old friends for my very much single days. Part of the great aspect of the weekend was just being able to show my daughter the Hollywood stars and spend quite a bit of time on the beach, introduce her to women who have actually read stories about her when she was 3 and 4 and 5, when I was writing Choosing Single Motherhood. I used a lot of anecdotes from our life together. My daughter spent hours playing in the ocean, and I was talking for quite a while there with my old friend Steve. He and I had basically been best friends for many years in New York City, did everything together, golf, tennis, movies. He never knew, actually, how close he came to being asked by me to be my donor. Sort of the bookend of being with somebody that I knew way back when, well before Sophie was ever around. With my friend Steve and several friends from Sports Illustrated, we shared a beach house on the New Jersey shore for several years. I remember that time vividly. It was a really wonderful time of my life, and here I was, a full 15 years later, introducing him to what has become a completely new life for me. Obviously, when you become a mom, everything transforms. No matter how much you plan, no matter how much you look into your future, no matter how much you think you know exactly who you are, where you fit in, who you belong with at periods of your life, completely changes over time. The leap of faith, the journey that we all take, is really to just take those steps, realize that it is going to completely transform our life in ways that we cannot predict. It is going to completely stress us out in many ways. But ultimately, we can't plan and think everything through. Life evolves, and we evolve with it. There are amazing moments that have created a life that I'm extremely happy about. The overall feeling I want most women to be able to experience, as I know many of you do understand, is that just let life happen as well as you can. yes, finances are going to be issues. Yes, there's going to be stress. Yes, you're going to have family and friends that don't understand what you're doing. You're going to have home maintenance issues, huge issues on health care, emergency planning that you need to be prepared for, work and career loss, relationships that end, friends that you thought were going to be there and no longer are. It's all part of the package. What stands out are these moments that we can have sitting with an old friend on the beach, watching our child frolic in the ocean. Unstructured time, as Carl Honoré will talk about in today's program, is all about just letting you see the magic in the moments. My first guest today is Carl Honoré, author of the book Under Pressure: Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. One of the things he does in the book is points out the danger of the what is a worldwide, it's not simply United States or North America, but the worldwide parental obsession to give children the best of everything, while, he says, at the same time, producing a generation of overscheduled, overstimulated, overstressed kids. He traveled all over the place, Finland, California, Italy, Hong Kong, to find a new and powerful movement of parents and teachers who are trying to put the child back into childhood. I know that one of the things that choice moms who are in the thinking stages in particular worry about is whether they're going to be a good single parent, whether they're going to be able to afford to send their children to the best of everything. And a lot of the things that Carl and I talked about can be very reassuring, while also reminding us that our own goal-oriented natures can sometimes get in the way of what our children actually really want from us as parents. So the first thing I asked Carl was simply to talk a little bit about his own background.
I'm a Canadian writer, but I live in London, England. My first book is called In Praise of Slowness, and it's about how the world got stuck in fast forward, trying to do everything more and more quickly. And the book chronicles how that backfires on us and looks at the many ways in which people are slowing down in every walk of life and finding that they do whatever it is they do better by slowing it down a bit. So that's In Praise of Slowness, which is translated now into, I think, 30-odd languages and has been an international bestseller. So my new book is called Under Pressure, and it's about modern childhood, I suppose. It's a kind of examination of what has happened around all of the sort of sound and fury and panic around growing up in the early 21st century and trying to make sense of what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. And it started, for me, the starting point was when I found myself falling into this hyper-parenting trap on a parent-teacher evening.
You start off your book, Under Pressure, with a great anecdote about what led you to, basically, I assume, write this book when your son said something to you. Can you kind of share with women that story?
For me, the whole starting point was a parent-teacher evening, and I was sitting, you will recognize that scenario, I'm sort of perched on a very low plastic seat, you know, looking up at the teacher, waiting for some pearl of praise to be dropped in my lap about my son, who was 7 at the time. And, you know, the feedback was good. It was nothing amazing until I went to the art room and the art teacher was just falling over herself and saying my son was wonderful. He was so creative. And look here on the wall. We have a sketch that he's done and we keep it there as a model for older pupils. And then she dropped what I think of as the G-bomb. She said, "Your son is a gifted young artist." I heard that word gifted and suddenly I didn't hear anything else. And I thought, my God, I'm raising the next Picasso. So I got on Google and I started finding an art tutor and art camp or something to polish this gift and turn my son's art into an achievement. And I found an art teacher, tutor, and I said to my son, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "No." He looked at me like I was from outer space. He said, "No, I just want to draw. Why can't I just draw?" And then he asked me the question, which I think it was the coup de grace, and it really was the starting point for writing this book. He said to me, "Why do grown-ups have to take over everything?" And it was one of those moments of searing epiphany when you suddenly see yourself from the side in sharp relief. And I saw myself standing there as a kind of hyper parent, and I just thought, whoa, you know, I've lost my bearings here. And that was the beginning of this journey.
One of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you for the Choice Mom audience, and one of the reasons your book grabbed my attention, was that women who that I work with who make the choice to have kids on their own are generally doing so after the age of 30. They've been in careers for a long time. They most often have postgraduate degrees. They're very strong-minded in many ways. They're very proactive because that's kind of what led them to make the decision to take this step in the first place. And I could certainly see, I see it with myself, I have two kids, 10 and 5, with being sort of goal-driven women in by nature, there is certainly going to be the tendency for many of us that we're going to have to curb to not direct our children. And I think you talk about being, you know, make them a project management. Yeah. So that was a big impetus behind me wanting to get in touch with you. Could you sort of give your overall advice to the women that will be listening to this program about what our tendencies are and how you yourself have not only recognized it, seen it in other places, but then what we're supposed to do about backing off?
Well, I think you've put your finger on the heart of the matter here, which is that this generation of and the mothers and the women who are principally your listeners are obviously right at the center of that demographic. But I think this is a phenomenon right across the culture, this feeling of everything being driven, competitive, pushed by targets. We've created a kind of management consultant ethos where we feel that if something cannot be measured or enhanced by tools and guru advice and expert help, then somehow it's not valid. And I think that it's very easy to fall into that way of thinking, especially if you're having children for the first time in your middle to late 30s. You've probably spent a lot of time worrying about getting pregnant. You may be thinking, this is my last, this is my last chance. I've got my one kid or maybe two. And then, of course, as you say, you've spent a lot of time in the workplace and you have imbibed this workplace ethos, which is that, how did you do anything better, whether it's parenting or running a marketing division? Well, you bring in the experts, you work long, hard hours at it, and you push hard, you impose targets, you professionalize parenting. And I think that the problem here is that starts off as a culture that works very well often in the workplace, but it doesn't work so well in the home. And that's the trouble is understanding. I think the first step is to recognize that parenting is not project management, it's not product development, and it's not a competitive sport. I think one of the first things to accept about parenting is that there is a lot of unknown and a lot of doubt, and parenting really ultimately should be a journey. It's about understanding and learning, helping your child find out who your child is, because I think a lot of us come now to the business of parenting with this notion that somehow our kids are a piece of putty that we will mold with our every act and our every expenditure, and everything we do will leave an indelible mark to create this perfect child, this alpha child, when in fact that's not the case. There's a limit to how much we can influence children, and in fact children are born with their own genetic traits and blueprints and so on. And I think a big part of growing up is finding out who you are, and really where a parent comes in is of course you've got to push, polish, and protect your kids, and children need to strive and struggle and stretch themselves, but they don't need to do that all the time, and that you don't need to turn childhood into a rat race. And ultimately, actually, I think the argument seems pretty clear both from scientific evidence but also from the anecdotal, that when we back off and give children the time and space that they need to explore the world on their own terms, to play freely without adults telling them how to play, the time to get bored, even. The children learn how to think creatively and invent when they learn how to socialize and get along with their peers. And it's when they learn, perhaps most importantly of all, how to stand on their own two feet and how to look into themselves and work out who they are rather than what we want them to be, which is ultimately what mothers of the demographic you're describing, but all parents really ultimately want is for children to grow up happy, healthy, and knowing who they are and where they fit into the world.
I know another tendency that can happen with this audience in particular, since we are single parents and we have a single paycheck, and very often many of us are working 40-hour work weeks, there is also that, you know, without being that stay-at-home mom, the kids are going to be in a variety of activities. We also feel guilty enough about what they might not have by missing a father in the home that there might also sometimes be that overcompensating. Well, I can at least, you know, send him to violin class, and I can do this and I can do that, and I'll coach his soccer team, and I'll, you know. So what sort of advice do you have, especially for the single parent who is trying almost to be super mom?
Yeah, so I suppose the first piece of advice is just to say, don't try to be super mom. I mean, there is no such thing as a super mom. And actually, anybody who ends up trying, I think it backfires in so many different ways. It backfires on the mom herself, because you become a small animal on a treadmill, running round and round and round in circles, and never not really living your life, but actually rushing through it. And I think the same experience then trickles into the child's world, that a kid then becomes a project with a to-do list. And I think it's very true, certainly for single parents, and I know lots of them in my own social circle, that there's a natural drift towards scheduling, especially during the work week, where you don't have the child care, and kids will, it's just simpler, and it makes sense often to have them in structured, organized activities. But what often happens in families that I see, single parent families, is that same approach then percolates into the weekend. So even when you're together and you're off the clock, you're away from the workplace, and you can actually unplug and spend some time together relaxing on the weekend, you don't, and you immediately start signing up for volleyball, for basketball, for archery, for Kumon math, and it just goes on and on and on. And I think it's so important to ring fence, to set aside and make sacred time every day if possible, but especially on days like the weekends when you're not tethered to the office, time that is just free time, in the sense of being not the child, not plunked in front of the PlayStation or the computer, but just free to play or to be with the parent or to talk or just simple things. These things don't have to, in fact, often it's better if they don't cost any money. It can be as simple as baking chocolate chip cookies or going for a walk in the park or reading a story together on a sofa. And ultimately, these things, which are small, simple, timeless, and universal, are the best things for child development. You know, I just heard a research piece recently came out saying that children, language development gains a lot more not from sitting in front of a DVD designed to teach them language and give them vocabulary, but they learn a lot more words by just simply being in the kitchen, listening to listening to a mother talking to a friend over tea, you know, just hearing adults talking or talking directly to an adult over dinner or over breakfast. And these things are they're within all of our reach. But because we are in this culture, this speedaholic, go faster, be busy all the time, if you're not active, you're roadkill culture, we've come to denigrate those moments of quiet, those moments of silence, those moments of just simple, unrestrained and unfettered play. You know, we see a kid with a ball kicking it around in the backyard, and we think, that looks like a waste of time. So we drag the child off to a soccer camp. There's a wonderful quote from William Blake, the English poet, who described childhood as seeing a world in a grain of sand and holding infinity in the palm of your hand. And it's that extraordinary, magical, transcendent moment when a child just disappears into a game or a story. You know, you're walking down the street and your daughter, 5-year-old, suddenly spots a ladybug in a rose bush, and she stops, and she can give that ladybug a name and watch it for 20 minutes, scampering up and down the rose petals, weave a whole narrative around it, a backstory. And there she is, disappeared into the richest, most fertile, most magical type of play, and her brain is being bashed into shape, and this is a moment of supreme child development. And yet we see that and we think, that looks a little bit like a waste of time. So we grab her by the wrist and we pull her off and say, you're late for ballet, come on. And I think it's about understanding that less is more, and that you can often achieve more, and children will achieve more by being left to their own devices, or just having you as a mother there, maybe hovering on the fringes. You're washing up in the kitchen, or you're doing some paperwork, and your child is just playing there on the floor beside you, and maybe she asks you a question every 15 minutes or so, or you get involved a little bit. But that kind of fluid, open time, which isn't structured and isn't organized, is so precious as well. I mean, it's so enjoyable. These are the moments we look back on, don't we? When our children are grown up, we don't tend to think back to all those hours we spent schlepping them off to volleyball in the people carrier. You know, we remember those little moments, you know, the back garden when the sun was disappearing behind the trees in the distance, the end of summer, and we had that barbecue, and it was just the two of us or the three of us. Those are the moments that give a human life meaning and texture and give it love and give it wings.
Myself, one of the things I remember the most about childhood was the times when we would sit on it was a Wednesday night, we'd sit with a tape recorder, because that's what we had then, and we would make or plays and interview each other, and of course it had a lot to do with what I do today. But that's one of the things that completely stands out, and it was one of those things that was because I grew up similarly to how I know you did, which I read about in the book, where, yeah, it was not at all structured. How did we get to this point of where, I guess the word that parents today seem to dread is when their child says they're bored?
Yes, it's funny, isn't it, that phrase, "Mom, I'm bored." I think a generation ago, and probably for not just a generation ago, but really throughout human history, when a child arrived and yanked on mom's skirt and said, "Mom, I'm bored," mom would just say, "Well, too bad, you know, go sort it out, go play, go make some fun, go do something." Whereas now, I think modern parents hear a child saying, "Mom or Dad, I'm bored," and it feels like a slap in the face. It feels like, you know, failure, parental failure, somehow in this world that is a smorgasbord of things to do and activities to experience and stimulation and diversion. You know, if you're bored, that seems like failure on a grand scale. And so our child comes to us now and says we're bored, and we panic, and we drop everything we're doing to stop that boredom. And I think that's in a way a reflection of the broader society we live in now, because I think every culture ends up with the childhood that reflects its own strengths and weaknesses and its own neuroses and paranoias. And let's face it, if we look at ourselves as grown-ups nowadays, we are overstructured, we're hyper-scheduled, we're busy all the time. And when we get a moment of unstructured time, a moment of boredom, what do? Well, we don't rejoice and make something up or relax. We panic and go online or reach for a magazine or something to get the stimulation going again. And I think that way of living, that modus vivendi, we've really injected that into childhood now, so that kids, I think, are losing the art of just playing on their own. Because I think a lot of kids now, every moment of their day is structured, supervised, organized, measured, benchmarked, and you give them a little bit of free time and they struggle. So I think for a lot of parents, especially the kind of parents who are listening to your program, of the moms, if you're trying to wean a child off that hyper-scheduled existence, you can't do it in the blink of an eye, because I think you've got to re-educate children, you've got to help them relearn that art of play. So you can't just say, okay, you're bored, start for the first time ever saying you're bored, you know, too bad, or good, go off and play. You maybe have to get the art stuff out on the kitchen table and sit down with them for 5-10 minutes to get the ball rolling, to get those muscles working again. And launch them off back into that world of play that is the essence of a childhood well-lived.
My last question to you is, you know, a lot of single parents in particular, especially women that proactively make this choice, there's that bad rap that comes with having a structure that doesn't include two parents. One of the people I have interviewed as well for the program is Rick Weisbord from Harvard, who has written a book also about moral parenting and who the vulnerable children are. And you make the point in your book too that, you know, a lot of our assumptions are that, you know, kids in poverty and kids in certain situations are being disserved, people growing up without fathers or both parents. Certainly there's a lot of challenges to that. But one of the things that's so surprising, and Rick has talked about this as well as you, is that, you know, a lot of the depression that kids are facing are not kids in these poverty areas or from certain family structures. You know, a lot of it is coming from people in the affluent suburbs. And can you talk a little bit more about what you found in your own research about who some of the vulnerable kids in society tend to be?
Yeah, well, what I found most fascinating, and in some ways most chilling, was that my basic assumption, I think our basic assumption as a culture is that what you just said a moment ago, which is that the children who are suffering most from mental illnesses and depression and anxiety and so on are at the bottom end of the socioeconomic scale, and that they're also always from broken homes and so on. And in fact, the picture is far more blurry and complex and nuanced than that. And in fact, there's a very, at the center of this debate, there's a key inversion, which is when you talk purely about socioeconomics, not one and two parent families, you just talk about affluence. It turns out now that the kids who are suffering from, childhood depression and anxiety and the self-harm, suicide, and substance abuse that often go along with it are now most prevalent, not in the urban ghettos where families are struggling to make ends meet. They're most prevalent in the smart downtown apartments and leafy suburbs where the go-getting middle classes are piling the pressure on their kids, project managing them. And I think that's a real marker that as a generation of parents, especially in that socioeconomic stratum, that we've lost our compass, we've lost our bearings, and that we start off from the noble and natural instinct, which is to do the best for our children. But by pushing too hard, that instinct has become a caricature of itself and is now backfiring on us, so that the kids who are ostensibly growing up in a perfect environment, so let's say that perfect environment is, a mom, a dad, a stable home, a wealthy home, a beautiful suburb, a kind of Kodak moment picture. Actually, these are the kids who are often suffering the most emotionally because they are under so much pressure to fill out that Kodak moment, to be the perfect child in a perfect family portrait. And it's grinding a lot of them down. And I think for the message that families, sort of single-parent families, should take away from that is that, because I think what often happens is that we end up, the media and just the culture in general, ends up vilifying the single family as being, a child who grows up in that environment is automatically doomed to be, a social failure, an economic failure, a psychological, when that, I think, is just patently untrue. There are so many different kinds of family units now. And what children need, whatever the family structure, they need the same things that they've always needed, because children now who are being born in 2009 have the same brains and the same biological makeup as children born in 1959, 1909, 2000 years. We haven't had a great leap forward evolutionary-wise, so kids have the same needs. They need to be nourished. Of course, they need the basic food and so on and shelter. But once you get past that, they need, as I was saying before, they need time and space to explore the world at their own pace, to play. And they need, from a stable adult or adults in their environment, I think they need love with no conditions attached. And I think that's so, so important now. I think a lot of affection and love in some of these high-achieving homes comes with conditions attached. It's kind of, here I am sacrificing maybe a bit of my career, sacrificing my weekend, sacrificing my figure, whatever it is, to get you into Harvard, And if you fail that test, if you fail to get an A+ on biology in grade 9, you're failing me. And I think that that's where a lot of this anxiety and anguish and psychological upheaval is coming from, is that unconditional love, that unconditional parental love has got mixed up with other things in a lot of these high-achieving families. And that's completely separate from whether you've got a mother or a father or both or whatever the family unit is. So I think the thing to hold to is that children need those basic things and that we can all give them. We can all supply them.
Well, thank you, Carl, and thank you for writing Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Author I've been talking to is Carl Honoré, and the book is available in most bookstores. Is that the case? It's online.
Yep. Okay. Yes, it is.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Carl.
Thank you. Thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Anyone who knows me well and knows the work that I do with the Choice Moms community understands that I take very seriously my responsibility of picking the kinds of sponsors that I work with. This is especially important in the case of sperm banks. One sperm bank that recently came to my attention because of the recommendation of a colleague that I respect very much in the mental health profession involved with fertility is Fertility Cryobank. This is a Los Angeles-based sperm bank
that draws from a diverse pool of donors in that area and is licensed to ship sperm anywhere in the United States. Fertility Cryobank is the only sperm bank in the U.S. to have pictures and video and audio of all its donors. It conducts genetic and psychological assessments on its donors. Its own owners have created their own families using sperm donation, so they do understand how important this decision is. Fertility Cryobank has never discriminated and has worked with all family types, including single moms and the lesbian and gay community, since its inception in 1996. It is for these reasons that I do suggest that women consider looking at the Fertility Cryobank. You can visit their website at fertilitycryobank.com. My second guest today is Peggy Drexler, author of Raising Boys Without Men: How Maverick Moms Are Creating the Next Generation of Exceptional Men. It's a book that she wrote several years ago, but certainly still makes the rounds, and we still talk about it on the Choice Mom discussion board. One of the things that Judith Wallerstein, who was the best-selling author of The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce, wrote about the book was that this is a comforting argument and an upbeat one for all the single parents out there, the divorcees who worry about their children, the growing number of women who have children without a husband, the growing number of fathers with sole custody of their children. Peggy and I first talked about something she and I have talked about in the past, which is namely, what are the strengths of single parenting that can often get overlooked?
Nikki, I would be glad to start with the strength, because there were many of them, contrary to what we read sometimes. Because the moms really spent a lot of time talking with them about their experiences and about their feelings, they were really very grounded and in touch with their own sense of self and their own feelings. They were very, very attuned and sensitive to other people. So that was a strength, and that came from mothers who I think traditionally are more engaged with their sons in emotional ways than perhaps fathers. I mean, that's a generalization, but I think in some ways it's an accurate one. The other thing that moms worry about raising boys is he going to be a sissy? And these boys had an innate ability, and that's something that you're born with, and that's what science tells us now. Your gender is not something that you form. It is reinforced by experience, but the truth is you're born a boy. And these boys were able not only to use the models that the mothers provided in the sense of introducing them to stable people that they could love and know over time, but they were able to form their own role models. The moms were very accepting of the fact that boys should be around boys, and so they hired babysitters and coaches and were very sensitive, and then the boys developed models, sports players, characters in books, Harry Potter, but really the mothers provided the fertilization for that, so to speak, and I have to add parenthetically that is really speaks to the fact that single moms don't hate men. They really try to provide the boys and girls with what they needed emotionally to grow and develop. Another strength that's been reported in the studies is that single moms tend to spend more time reading and talking to their kids, so that the kids tend to read earlier. The other thing that I found was that the moms went out of their comfort zone to really engage in activity that the boys liked, that the moms may not have liked. And I'm laughing because one mom was telling me, and this was a single mom, that her son loved pillow fights and she hated them. You know, she always thought somebody would get bonked in the head, but she said, okay, 15 minutes, we're going to have this pillow fight. You know, it was something that she did because she loved her son. So they went out of their comfort zone, as I said, running, playing games that they might not normally do because they wanted to engage their sons in activities that interested them.
Could you kind of talk a little bit about the kinds of things that, you know, typically we are afraid that if we're too close to our sons, it will somehow hurt them. What kinds of advice that you have?
Well, first of all, you know, boys are hardwired, as I say. They're going to be boys. Ain't nothing a mother can do about that. And that I say somewhat defensively to the world, because this is what the world says, foists on mothers, and this is what mothers absorb, that I am going to do something to jeopardize, you know, his sexuality. And I say jeopardize because somehow a mom has been blamed if a son is gay, which is ridiculous because all the science points to that that's genetic as well. So his sexual orientation is what his sexual orientation is going to be. And his gender identification, the fact that he's a boy, is that he's a boy. I think if moms can relax about that, that will take the onus off of their concerns. It did come up with a lot of moms, am I doing the right thing by not having a man in my bedroom or a man down the hall? Is this somehow going to make him less boyish? But what I found, Mickey, which was fascinating to me, is that these boys were more boyish because my study involved comparing boys from single mom families to and two mom families to mom and dad families, that the boys from the mom group were more boyish than the other boys. And of course, that could be due to mothers providing encouraging sports and more so-called masculine activities. But these boys loved sports. They came from families where their abilities were encouraged, and somehow they really were able to use all the support and encouragement they got at home. And these were, you know, boys who was captain of the soccer team and baseball. This is in some ways why I called these boys head and heart boys, because they were able to play in the mud and do all kinds of silly, goofy kind of boyish things. And yet they, you know, were in the kitchen cooking. Also, they were sensitive to other people's feelings. So perhaps as a result that the moms were older and more established, perhaps the result of the fact that these were welcomed, well-thought-out births and kids that were very much wanted, and perhaps because they lived more on the margin of what's tradition, they were prepared to deal with a whole range of behaviors. Bette Midler had endorsed my book. After reading it, she said, books like mine, in endorsing things that we don't normally believe, that moms can raise kids all by themselves and do a good job, she said, they're attacked for the truths they tell, and there's no greater truth that you can tell the nation's single mothers that relax. If you love him and support him and listen to him, he'll turn out just fine. And I really believe that, Mickey, because I've seen it. I've seen it on a day-by-day basis, on a week-by-week basis, and even a year-by-year basis, because I saw these kids over time.
In terms of the politics of single parenting, there's a lot of feelings that a single-parent home can't possibly be as solid for anyone. And of course, there's statistics that a lot of the troubled youth come from single parent homes based on a variety of factors. So if we could talk a little bit about what those fears, concerns are based on.
It's not only the single mothers that are attacked, but the people who, like myself, who go into the single mothers' homes and talk about what the strengths are. It's very complicated because I think that part of the assumption of people who believe that single mothers shouldn't be raising kids, despite the fact that there are so many and the numbers are growing anyway, and that these kids are coming into the world and some of them are doing just fine, and some of them don't have society, political, and social support, and so it's an income level question. But They believe that single mothers by choice are single by choice because they must hate men, so that they reinforce a woman's notion of the rottenness of men because they have made a choice to have a child without a man. Now, that's ridiculous, as we both know. But then they go on to elaborate that it's a very selfish act, that to have a child as a single mom, that the mother is not only hating men, but deliberately depriving her child of a dad without acknowledging that, you know, role models are all over, and boys are boys, and boys can engage with men. There's that it's a selfish act, that women hate men, that they somehow are supporting this notion that men don't have to stand by their families. So they take this notion, women in lower income situations who are left by men, and they say, see, women who are out there having children endorse this notion that it's okay to raise a child without a man, and therefore men don't feel the responsibility and feel that it's okay to leave. Now this, they say, is instigated or exacerbated by middle to upper middle class women who have chosen to have a child, who can support their child, and who do it out of many reasons, but certainly not because they hate men. There was a piece in the Atlantic Monthly by a woman, but she accused me of being afraid of straight men because she saw my study as an attack on men, that I was afraid of straight men, and that I was joining the open season that men are under siege, and that by supporting moms, that this is an attack on men. It's a real mother-blaming situation that has extended itself to blaming single moms, and that it's moms' fault who have kids, that the men are not there because the men see that they don't have to stand by their women because other women are doing it, and it's considered not big deal.
Now, I'm going to kind of put you on the spot a little bit, or maybe put your husband on the spot. From the perspective, then, of somebody who has written this book, who's looked at the homes, and who raised children with a husband, what could you say about what children lack when they don't have of a father in the home? Your own children presumably have benefited greatly from your husband's presence. So sort of how would you talk to the people about how the two compare?
You know, Mickey, I have to say that a mom and dad family works great, provided it is working great. Let me say that there are many, many divorced families out there where kids are subjected to a lot of strife and tension and fighting in the home. You know, there are fathers who are models, who go to work, support the family, but are not men to model, who are abusive to the kids and so forth. So my point is that a two-parent family is not necessarily better just because there's a mom and dad in the home. Now, the flip side of that is, of course, if you have two parents in the home, and who says it has to be a mom and dad? It could be two moms. It could be a mom and grandmother. And the truth of the matter is that it is easier for one to take over when the other's tired. If a kid can push one parent's buttons for the other parent to step in. My daughter, this was when she was young, we very much wanted her to learn how to ride a bike. And she wanted to, but she was afraid. Came the day that she wanted to learn, and she said she was sick again. And I said, you know, she doesn't have to go. She's sick. She doesn't have to go. My husband said, no, I think she can do it. I think she can go. My daughter went, and not reluctantly. I mean, she clearly liked the support. But she came home, and she was riding her bike, and she felt like a million bucks. So here he, you know, my tendency to maybe coddle or to give in to expressions of anxiety, let's say, he was able to counteract with a more objective, proactive kind of approach, and it was the right thing. Now, if let's say she was living with me exclusively, maybe she'd never learn how to ride a bike. You know, it's true with skiing also. She gets so much pleasure out of it, and it's such a wonderful, wonderful sport with her. But he started her young, and I, again, was overly cautious and feeling that it was really not necessary and so forth. Those are examples from my own family. A friend of mine said, you have a sick kid. The kid is waking up every hour, let's say. And I'm quoting my friend. She said, you start off feeling sorry for your kid and you end up feeling very sorry for yourself because you're dead tired. Now, if you can do a rotation, your partner goes, that's going to make it a lot easier. You're going to be less irritable in the morning. You can be more loving to your kid. Obviously, it's better, but I have to say, Mickey, that none of these are deal breakers in the sense that this is not going to make or break a kid. If a parent, and it doesn't have to be a mother, it can be a father, is sensitive to their child, is empathetic to their child, is supporting, is allowing them independence and not trying to put them in a slot, the kid is going to turn out all right, even if there's one parent or two parents. But clearly, you know, two parents can be an advantage in some of the ways that I've discussed and other ways as well. I'll give you one more example. She's learning to drive now, my daughter. My husband is teaching her. I would not be able to teach her. I would be too uptight, and I would, you know, instill my own concerns about, you know, her independence and being on the road and would inhibit the situation, quite frankly. He feels more comfortable about it. I feel more comfortable talking about difficulties with friends, or she gets a mark and that she doesn't like and she feels badly about it. I feel more comfortable talking about those things than my husband does. So I think you get my drift.
For the Q&A section of today's show, I'm going to turn to an email that came across to the Choice Moms discussion board recently from a typical thinker named Michelle. She is new to the thinking stage, and she wondered if the women on the board could give her some advice about whether she might have what it takes to be a single mom. And really, that's what today's show is all about. We have so many natural doubts and fears of our own, but also those that are foisted upon us by community. We're afraid that we won't be accepted by family and friends or from the outside community, or that our children will be stigmatized from the decisions that we make. So one of the things that she asked is, do I have what it takes to be a single mom? And one of the many responses she got was from a woman on the board named Mary Ellen, who said, yes, you probably do. There are days when it is hard, but overall, it is great. As to the question about whether it's fair to the baby to go into it being a single parent, Mary Ellen said it's one that she too had struggled with. But my daughter and I have an incredible bond, and I'm not sure it would be quite as great if there was another parent. It's still a hard question that we all struggle with. Mary Ellen also pointed out that she found the thinking stage to be the hardest part of this journey. Now that I have my daughter, she said, I can't understand why it was so hard. Now I can't imagine my life without her, so it seems all the thinking made no sense, but of course at the time it did. My only regret now is that I didn't start sooner. This question comes up a lot on the board, and what so many women do say is, yes, the thinking stage is incredibly important. You have to go through the issues that you're facing, be honest about them, but many of them have advised that they wish they had started sooner than they did. In hindsight, they said they realized a lot of the things that were tripping them up were not ultimately as important as it was as they faced their own fertility challenges later in life. And also others have said that because they wish they were able to have more than one child, they too wish they had started at least in their early 30s. Now again, we don't advocate for women to just jump into this. There are a lot of things that we talk about at the workshops, and the discussion board is a great place to really be able to hear women talk about the things that they're facing. So for today's resources, suggested resources and recommended reading, I'm going to refer you specifically to the choicemoms.org website. Under resources, we have a variety of things listed, including a link to the Choice Moms discussion board, which now has more than 1,000 members on it. There's also a link to the Single Mothers by Choice Network, which has local support groups around the country. You'll also there find links to a variety of single parent bloggers who deal with the stresses, strains, and joys of single parenting on a day-to-day basis.
If you would like to be considered as a Choice Mom sponsor on this radio show, at workshops, or on the website, the fastest method to a green light is to ask one of your single women clients to recommend you by email to info@choicemoms.org. We're interested in working with anyone who offers high-quality products and services for women, lesbian and straight, who are thinking about becoming a mother on their own, who are trying to become a mother on their own through conception or adoption, who are single parents in that first year of baby boot camp, and who are experienced single moms who deal with the stress, financial obligations, and ongoing needs of parenting their kids on a 24/7 basis. For more resources about today's show topic, visit the choicemoms.org website, particularly the growing library of articles in the Trying, Waiting, Becoming, and Being sections. The Being section is for women beyond the newborn stage of motherhood, and you'll find there, for example, a link to the great stress-busting mom song that's on YouTube, useful any day you need to put a smile on your face. My original book, Choosing Single Motherhood, The Thinking Woman's Guide, is available online and in most bookstores as a major guidebook for anyone considering, choosing, or living this lifestyle. It contains a particular chapter devoted to dealing with the stress of single parenthood. Finally, the choicemoms.org website, the blogs, and this radio show are created for and by the Choice Mom community. Send questions you'd like me to respond to or ask my network of experts about to experts@choicemoms.org. In the meantime, I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of Choosing Single Motherhood, for single women who are determined to proactively become a mother on their own. I'm your host, Mickey Morissette, founder of Choice Moms and the choicemoms.org website. I look forward to talking with you again next week. As always, welcome to the discussion and welcome to the journey.